This is Read On Air with Red Zell, for those passionate about books.
Hello and welcome to Read On Air, the show all about books that belongs to you. I'm your host, Red Zell, and this week, with winter now officially over, we've got a spring in our step and are frolicking through the fields of comedy. Robert Kirkwood brings us a world exclusive from writer and comedian Limmy.
I like baddies, I like psychopaths, and not in real life.
I'll unearth a hidden gem read by a national treasure before he was famous.
A wave retires and leaves me sprawling like a starfish on the sand. And I get up and look back and find that I've been swimming for my life in 2 feet of water.
And Joe Brand tells us about the funny business of moving her onstage humour onto the page.
And because it meant I could stay in a bit, I said yes.
That's all coming up in today's show. Brian Limond, or Limmy, is a Scottish comedian and author, best known for his self-titled Limmy's Show. He also branched into writing with his first book, Daft Wee Stories, which quickly became a bestseller in 2015. And now he's back with a new book. And, as with Daft Wee Stories, he recorded the audiobook version at the RNIB Talking Books Studio in Glasgow. Before he chats to Robert, here's a world exclusive. For the first time anywhere, here's Limmy reading from his brand new book, That's Your Lot.
I'm sitting in a bin. I'm not doing it for a dare. There isn't anybody around that I'm showing off to. I haven't woken up here after a night on the piss. This isn't something I'm going to tell everybody about later and they'll all pat me on the back and tell me I'm a legend. It's quite sad, actually, I think. This bin I'm in, it's my bin. It's my wheelie bin. I'm in my wheelie bin, in the bin area for my block, around the back. It's 2 a.m, I'm freezing, and I'm crouched down in my bin with the lid shut. I'm standing up a bit now, and pushing the lid open and having a look out. I'm looking up to the back of the building, the back of the tenement building that I live in. I'm looking at flat 3-1, where I live. And now I'm looking below my flat, at flat 2-1, where Nick stays. Nick's probably all wrapped up in bed right now, all cosy. I'm thinking about just getting out. Maybe I should just get out and go upstairs and get back into my bed as well. Maybe have a shower to get rid of the smell, then get into my bed and get all cosy. But when I think about it, I know that if I do that, then I'll just be right back to square one. That'll change. So I'm crouching back down and shutting the lid, and I'm just going to sit here.
Limmy reading from his brand new book, That's Your Lot. And Limmy joins me now. Now you've just finished recording the book. How do you feel?
Oh, knackered. It's strangely knackering just to read a book. I know there's a lot of workies and all that would disagree about how knackering that type of work is, but actually is. Really, it's maybe the hardest job there is.
It's called That's Your Lot. Does that mean it's your last book?
No. Some people have asked us that. It kind of means, see, the stories are all be a bit, they're not depressing, but they've all got lives, a lot of them are kind of about lives that are sort of ruined or bad endings. Like a kind of thing, like, if you're unhappy with your life, well, sorry, but that's your lot. It's that type of thing. It's a bit like, you know, Peggy Lee. Is that all there is? Is that kind of white? No, there's nothing else I can do anyway. You know, I wouldn't dump this for anything else.
So it's a lot darker than Daft Wee Stories.
It's a bit darker, it's a wee bit more kind of serious, less kind of punchlines in them. There's lots of funny things, but less kind of boom-tish sort of endings that I had at Daft Wee Stories. So they're a wee bit more serious, so when I do the book reading stuff, it's going to be, there's only a few stories that are kind of good for reading out. Mm. The rest of them are all too, a bit glum, but that's the sort of thing that makes me laugh.
And quite hateful characters, and I'm thinking specifically about the last longer story, Benidorm.
Oh, aye, the story Benidorm is about a guy that's maybe some kind of psycho or something, but I like baddies, I like psychopaths, and not in real life, but, well, for afar, I love them for afar. So I like, he's a not a nice person, but I like people who aren't very nice, but there's a side to him, you go, well, maybe it's because of this, maybe it's because of that, but the same could be said for the worst people in all of humanity.
And why is it not called My Moz Had Her Heed Kicked In?
Oh, that, I said on Twitter the other day, Well, I had this sketch and I had this wee video of one of my live shows. Mum's had her head kicked in. And there's a funny thing, and people, it doesn't sound funny when you just say it like that, right? But it's kind of funny in the video, right? And I thought, I want something that just sounds sort of mad, and I was going to call the book Mum's Had Her Head Kicked In or something like that. But then my girlfriend reminded me that even though she likes that video, she thinks that's funny, there are books that are called something like that and they're serious.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they've got the kind of handwriting font at the front and a faded picture of Wayne at the front. You know, it's like somebody's childhood where the maw really did get her head kicked in. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, aye, right enough. And I would have to explain my sense of humour to people. I'm sorry you find that funny, dear. But aye, and no. So it's hard to explain. So I just went, no, I won't do it.
Was it easier second time around, both the writing and the reading of the audio version?
The writing, the longest one, at Benidorm one, like 10,000 words, that was a lot harder than writing 2,000 word ones. I like kind of wee bursts, sort of sitting in a cafe or sitting in the house and having an idea and you just start typing. And it usually lasts about 2,000 words. But one of these longer ones, that gets harder. But I don't know, it's a bit the same. I think maybe Daffy's stories was a bit easier. I don't know, because I was coming up with lots of daft stuff, really daft stuff. This, I wanted it to be a wee bit more, still kind of daft, but in some ways it was easier because Daffy's stories has got these wee punchlines. How's it going to end? How's it going to end? Whereas this, I was just thinking more about what's happening in the middle rather than the ending.
Mm-hmm.
The only way to find it is by listening.
Would you ever do a full-length novel?
I want to, but my next one, I want to do it. I've been thinking of ideas, and I think I could do it this way, then that way, but I think, like a lot of people writing a book, you just go like that. I can't do it. I know I can't do it. It's just rubbish. It's just pointless. It's rubbish. So I've been thinking about doing a novel that's sort of more like short stories pieced together, that type of thing, rather than chapters where, well, it's just kind of character building story, you know, like sort of building things up. I like, because I come from a sketch writing background and this short story, or these short stories sort of background, it suits my mind better to think of everything as wee snippets, a wee short story. So that's what I want to do with the third one. It's maybe a hybrid between a book of short stories and a novel. Mm-hmm. So we'll see.
Now, when we talked before, you just finished reading Daft Wee Stories, and I think during the interview I might have used the word narrative, and I've since discovered you don't like that word. What have you got against the word narrative?
The reason why I hate it is because it is everywhere. It's politics, sports stuff, it's everywhere controlling it. I was saying to somebody today that, since me saying that I don't like the word narrative, I get tweeted it all the time, examples of it in the radio or telly, and there's somebody tweeting me like a wee video, a football commentator saying Ronaldo or whoever is very much controlling the narrative on the pitch, and it's politics stuff. The narrative, got to change the narrative. Narrative, 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 it's used in place of talking point of view. It's used just, it's hard to explain. I must sound a wee bit mad to anybody going, I don't get what his problem is. But once you spot it, wasn't it, a couple of years ago, it wasn't there. And then just suddenly, it's rocketed, it's everywhere. It's everywhere. But I watched a video the other day where a guy said, you have to stop this talking point of saying everything is fake news. And I'm like, he could have used the word narrative there instead of talking point. It's changing. It's changing. It's talking point. I couldn't believe it. Like, it's happening now. It's over. Light at the end of the tunnel.
And if I used it in the interview with you last time, I'm sorry. Now, what are you reading just now?
I'm not reading anything. I'm not much of a reader, funnily enough. It's probably why my vocabulary isn't very big. It isn't very lots. If you read my book, I've got the word stupid a lot, and I don't really use a lot of words, so maybe it's because I don't read a lot and I don't have a lot of different things going in my head. I've just got the ideas that I've got, but not really reading anything. I read a kind of Stephen King thing, and then I sort of stop if it starts to feel a bit too long or I lose interest. But I was reading some short stories by Raymond Carver, who I hadn't heard about a while back, and he's dead now, some 70s short story writer, and I really liked his stuff, and it kind of influenced That's Your Lot a wee bit, because they're more about mundane stuff and relationships and all that, and I just liked it. It just ends. Mm-hmm. The stories just end, rather than, oh, there's this kind of like beginning, middle and end, and it's all leading up to this event at the end. It's just slice of life sort of stuff, they call it. So that kind of rubbed off on me a wee bit with the type of stories I was doing. But that's it. Other than that, I'm not reading anything.
That's Your Lot will be released in audio on the same day as the print version. When will that be?
That's Your Lot comes out on the 4th of May, or May the 4th, and one way to remember that is May the 4th be with you, which has got nothing to do with Star Wars at all.
And now on RNIB Connect Radio, another clip from Lemmy's book, That's Your Lot.
I thought it would be obvious to everybody which bin was mine, but people would dump their bags in it anyway. So I got a pen and wrote my flat number on the lid, and then it stopped. Well, almost stopped. The students that lived downstairs in the flat that Nick's now in, they'd still sometimes dump their bags in my bin, even though my flat number was on it. They didn't date as often as before, but they still did it. But then they moved it, and I thought it would stop there. But then Nick moves in, and a week after he moved in, I came down here with a bag, I opened my bin, the one with flat 3-1 written on it, and instead of seeing an empty bin, it was full. I tore open the bag to see if I could find an envelope to see an address. Not that I would ever do anything. Not that I would take the envelope to the person's door to show that I'd caught them. Because I don't think you're allowed to open some of these bin bags, even if they're in your own bin. But I wanted to know.
And indeed, that's our lot from Lemmy until production of his book is complete next month. It will, of course, then be available for download from the RNIB Talking Books Library. My thanks to Robert and to Lemmy for that exciting news. Have you written about how you see life? Maybe you write a blog or have published a book. We'd love to hear from you. The address is readonair@rnib.org.uk. This week, the pavements were thronged with hordes of Harry Potters and multitudes of Matildas as people everywhere celebrated World Book Day. Roald Dahl's characters continue to bring pleasure to adults and children alike. So we thought we'd celebrate World Book Day by taking you back to the day the master storyteller came to the RNIB studios to record James and the Giant Peach. But before he began, he revealed what inspired him to write the book.
James and the Giant Peach was the very first of the children's books I've written. I had a couple of children of my own, and I used to tell them stories in bed, and one day I told them one that they seemed to like and wanted more of. And so I thought, well, why don't I try to write a children's book about it? And so I did.
James and the Giant Peach by Roald Dahl.
It all started on a blazing hot day in the middle of summer. Aunt Sponge, Aunt Spiker, and James were all out in the garden. James had been put to work as usual. This time he was chopping wood for the kitchen stove. Aunt Sponge and Aunt Spiker were sitting comfortably in deck chairs nearby, sipping tall glasses of fizzy lemonade and watching him to see that he didn't stop work for one moment. Aunt Sponge was enormously fat and short. She had small, piggy eyes, a sunken mouth, and one of those white, flabby faces that looked exactly as though it had been boiled. She was like a great, white, soggy, overboiled cabbage. Aunt Spiker, on the other hand, was lean and tall and bony, and she wore steel-rimmed spectacles that fixed onto the end of her nose with a clip. She had a screeching voice and long, wet, narrow lips, and whenever she got angry or excited, little flecks of spit would come shooting out of her mouth as she talked. And there they sat, these two ghastly hags, sipping their drinks and every now and again screaming at James to chop faster and faster. They also talked about themselves, each one saying how beautiful she thought she was. Aunt Sponge had a long-handled mirror on her lap, and she kept picking it up and gazing at her own hideous face. "I look and smell," Aunt Sponge declared, "as lovely as a rose. Just feast your eyes upon my face, observe my shapely nose. Behold my heavenly silky locks, and if I take off both my socks, you'll see my dainty toes. But don't forget, Aunt Spiker cried, how much your tummy shows. Aunt Sponge went red. Aunt Spiker said, my sweet, you cannot win. Behold my gorgeous curvy shape, my teeth, my charming grin. Oh, beauteous me, how I adore my radiant looks, and please ignore the pimple on my chin. My dear old trout, Aunt Sponge cried out, you're only bones and skin. Such loveliness as I possess can only truly shine in Hollywood, Aunt Sponge declared. Oh, wouldn't that be fine? I'd capture all the nation's hearts, they'd give me all the leading parts, the stars would all resign. I think you'd make, Aunt Spiker said, a lovely Frankenstein. Poor James was still slaving away at the chopping block. The heat was terrible. He was sweating all over. His arm was aching. The chopper was a large, blunt thing far too heavy for a small boy to use. And as he worked, James began thinking about all the other children in the world and what they might be doing at this moment. Some would be riding tricycles in their garden. Some would be walking in cool woods and picking bunches of flowers. And all the little friends whom he used to know would be down by the seaside playing in the wet sand and splashing around in the water. Great tears began oozing out of James's eyes and rolling down his cheeks. He stopped working and leaned against the chopping block, overwhelmed by his own unhappiness.
And this version of James and the Giant Peach is available as TB6212 from the Talking Books Library, where you can find all of Roald Dahl's other classic tales in a range of accessible formats.
This is Read On Air.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download. The RNIB Library also caters for adults and children in both Braille and giant print, so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
There were four of us, George and William Samuel Harris and myself and Montmorency. We were sitting in my room smoking and talking about how bad we were. Bad from a medical point of view, I mean, of course. We were all feeling seedy, and we were getting quite nervous about it. Harris said he felt such extraordinary fits of giddiness come over him at times that he hardly knew what he was doing. And then George said that he had fits of giddiness too, and hardly knew what he was doing. With me, it was my liver that was out of order. I knew it was my liver that was out of order because I'd just been reading a patent liver pill circular in which were detailed the various symptoms by which a man could tell when his liver was out of order. I had them all.
So begins one of the best-known and most-loved comedy novels ever written. Three Men in a Boat by Jerome K. Jerome has not been out of print since it was first published in 1889. It has sold millions of copies worldwide, including in the US, where it was a runaway success, and in Russia, where it was a set text at school. The opening paragraphs set the scene for the gloriously silly adventure that follows. Jay, the narrator, and his two friends, Harris and George, have what he describes as a general disinclination to work, so decide that they need a holiday to recharge their batteries. They hit on the idea of a fortnight on the Thames, rowing by day and camping by night, from Kingston to Oxford and back. Their companion on the journey is Montmorency, Jay's unruly dog. What follows is a wonderfully funny series of mishaps, digressions, tall stories and reflections on life that never fails to make me laugh. This is largely because Jerome K. Jerome's humour is timeless. He's a brilliant observer of human character and describes the knots that we tie ourselves into with glee. Every family has an Uncle Podger.
You never saw such a commotion up and down a house in all your life as when my Uncle Podger undertook to do a job. A picture would have come home from the frame makers and be standing in the dining room waiting to be put up. And Aunt Podger would ask what was to be done with it, and Uncle Podger would say, "Oh, you leave that to me. Don't any of you worry yourselves about that. I'll do all that." And then he would take off his coat and begin. He would send the girl out for 6 pennyworth of nails, and then one of the boys after her to tell her what size to get. And from that, he would gradually work down and start the whole house. "Now, you go and get me hammer, Will," he would shout. "And you bring the rule, Tom. I shall want the stepladder. I better have a kitchen chair, too. And Jim, you run round to Mr. Goggles and tell him Pa's kind regards, hopes his leg's better, and will he lend him his spirit level. And don't you go, Maria, because I shall want somebody to hold me the light. And when the girl comes back, she must go out again for a bit of picture cord. And Tom, where's Tom? Tom, you come here. I shall want you to hand me up the picture." And then he would lift up the picture and drop it, and it would come out of the frame, and he would try to save the glass and cut himself. And then he would spring round the room looking for his handkerchief. He couldn't find his handkerchief because it was in the pocket of the coat he'd taken off, and he didn't know where he'd put the coat, and all the house had to leave off looking for his tools and start looking for his coat, while he would dance around and hinder them. "Doesn't anybody in the whole house know where my coat is? I never came across such a set in all my life. Upon my word, I didn't. 6 of you, and you can't find a coat that I put down not 5 minutes ago. Well, of all the..." And then he'd get up and find that he'd been sitting on it, and would call out, "Ah, you can give it up. I've found it myself now. Might just as well ask the cat to find anything as expect you people to find it."
Even before Jay, Harris and George start their shambolic pleasure cruise, their plans begin to unravel. And they begin to squabble. Three Men in a Boat is the blueprint for every humorous adventure caper that followed it, from Jeeves and Wooster to the Top Gear specials, in which Clarkson, Hammond and May drove old bangers across continents in the hope that the wheels wouldn't fall off. But Jerome K. Jerome's humour is gentle, self-deprecating and universal. Who hasn't felt the same gap in expectations between the prospect of swimming in the sea and the reality?
"They seem to keep a specially cutting east wind waiting for me when I go to bathe in the early morning. And they pick out all the three-cornered stones and put them on the top, and they sharpen up the rocks and cover the points over with a bit of sand so that I can't see them. And they take the sea and put it 2 miles out, so that I have to huddle myself up in my arms and hop, shivering, through 6 inches of water. And when I do get to the sea, it's rough and quite insulting. One huge wave catches me up and chucks me in a sitting posture as hard as ever it can, down into a rock which has been put there for me. And before I've said, 'Oh!' and found out what has gone, the wave comes back and carries me out to mid-ocean. I begin to strike out frantically for the shore and wonder if I shall ever see home and friends again, and wish I'd been kinder to my little sister when a boy, when I was a boy, I mean. And just when I've given up all hope, a wave retires and leaves me sprawling like a starfish on the sand. And I get up and look back and find that I've been swimming for my life in 2 feet of water."
This is situation comedy at its best. It pokes fun at people's pretensions while applauding their refusal to give up in the face of adversity. At its heart is a celebration of friendship. Maybe that's why it continues to be such a favourite around the world, both as a book and in adaptation. But funnily enough, Jerome K. Jerome didn't set out to write a comedy classic. He wanted to write a travel guide about boating on the Thames. So, interspersed with the slapstick, there are historical passages about places of interest, such as Hampton Court Palace and Magna Carta Island. Not everyone likes these, but with mishap always lying just round the next bend, they do provide breathing space between fits of the giggles. I love the fact that Jerome K. Jerome wrote this book having just returned from making the same trip with his wife on their honeymoon. The book is full of the joy of living. Life is to be savoured, even if sometimes it feeds you lemons.
That canvas wanted more putting up than I think any of us had bargained for. It looked so simple in the abstract. You took 5 iron arches, like gigantic croquet hoops, and fitted them up over the boat, and then stretched the canvas over them and fastened it down. It would take quite 10 minutes, we thought. That was an underestimate. We took up the hoops and began to drop them into the sockets placed for them. You would not imagine this to be dangerous work, but looking back now, the wonder to me is that any of us are alive to tell the tale. They were not hoops, they were demons. First, they would not fit into their sockets at all, and we had to jump on them and kick them and hammer at them with the boat hook. And when they were in, it turned out that they were the wrong hoops for those particular sockets, and they had to come out again. But they would not come out until two of us had gone and struggled with them for 5 minutes, when they would jump up suddenly and try to throw us into the water and drown us. They had hinges in the middle, and when we were not looking, they nipped us with these hinges in delicate parts of the body. And while we were wrestling with one side of the hoop and endeavouring to persuade it to do its duty, the other side would come behind us in a cowardly manner and hit us over the head.
Over the years, I've listened to various recordings. The one featured today, Talking Book number 1391, is a hidden gem read by a very young Michael Aspel. For a more contemporary recording, Hugh Laurie's brilliant performance is available to buy commercially. His voice is perfect for the part, but the book is heavily abridged, which is a shame. In addition to the version read by Michael Aspel, the RNIB has another recording by Martin Jarvis, and Overdrive gives you access to two more, including a very entertaining performance by Stephen Crossley. Three Men in a Boat is also available in other accessible formats from the library, as is the sequel, Three Men on the Bummel, also read by Michael Aspel, in which the trio and Montmorency swap their boat for bikes and cause chaos in the Black Forest. That's TB1392. Have you found a hidden gem in the library? Why not tell us about it? The address to write to is readonair@rnib.org.uk. When comedian Jo Brand had children, she decided, for reasons we'll discover in a moment, that she should turn her talents to writing. Two of her books are now in the RNIB library, and at a recent book festival, she talked to our interviewer Claire Carson about them both. First of all, Look Back in Hunger.
We never refused the appallingly badly cooked first course at school for fear we would be denied pudding. I loved most puddings. They were possibly about 12,000 calories a throw, but they compensated for the cow's perineum under a blanket of pastry you had just forced down. Unfortunately, these spongy puddings were always served with that standard school accompaniment, lumpy custard, which all but ruined them for me. So I developed a painstaking way of raking the custard over the pudding so that it was thin enough to identify the lumps, which I would then remove and dispose of, sometimes into a handy tissue, if I had one, which I didn't very often, or I would just smear them under the table. Yum. Similar to custard in some ways, and a horror for me, was pink blancmange. I never knew what it was supposed to be, strawberry, raspberry or what. It could have been beetroot for all the flavour it had. The worst thing about it was the thick layer of skin on top. It would have been fine if it could have been lifted up, like a blancmange blanket, and deposited somewhere. But the cooks always seemed to make sure it was broken up and stirred in, so every mouthful had a little or big lump in it. It still makes me feel slightly sick when I think of it.
Well, it's my memoirs, which means it's basically my autobiography with lots of lies in them. Where did the idea come from? Oh, it's so tedious, but I was just asked if I would want to write it. And because it meant I could stay in a bit, I said yes.
And writing came really after you had children.
Yeah, it did. And again, that was related to some extent because when I had kids, A, I was absolutely shattered all the time. B, I didn't want to go out because I had food all down me and baby things. And so in a lot of ways, it was very convenient for me to stay at home and write rather than try and drag my tired, irritable body around the comedy clubs.
So the book that is in Talking Books is called It's Different for Girls. Tell us about that book as well.
Well, Different for Girls in some ways is a sort of evocation of my teenage years, slightly shifted in a parallel sense. So my mother doesn't know quite how awful I was. And it's set in Hastings, which is where I was a teenager. And, I mean, it's just really an attempt to kind of portray the sort of hypersensitivity that's experienced by teenagers about relationships, about their peer group, about getting older, about all those kind of very difficult things that actually are multiplied by 100 when you're a teenager, because you just really don't know who you should be and how you should be that person you want to be, really. And it's funny, hopefully.
Dealing with humour is such a wonderful release. Is that something that you use a lot in your writing? Obviously, it's your métier as a comedian, but to translate that into writing, was that really obvious?
Well, I think there's a big difference between writing in a humorous way and doing stand-up, because in stand-up you have to have roughly 4 jokes a minute or else audiences fall off to sleep or start throwing things at you. Whereas you can be a little bit more relaxed when you're writing a novel, and actually the whole sort of ethos of the book can be humorous without you actually laboriously having to write a joke per paragraph. So in some ways it's less stressful writing, because the humour can come out of your characters and out of situations rather than actually having to write one-liners.
When you were younger and looking ahead to your life, did you ever think that you would have done the things that you have done?
I don't think you can ever predict how your life's going to be. You know, when I was a kid, I wanted to have 15 children and live on a farm. And I still wouldn't mind doing that, but obviously it's a bit too late for the 15 children, because I'm well into my 50s now. So I think it's impossible to predict. It's something I always wanted to do, and I don't really think of myself as a person that sort of achieves everything at all costs. I just sort of forced myself initially to go on stage, and that was really hard to do, but it was certainly lubricated by a lot of alcohol the first time. And then once I'd done it once, I thought, well, I can do it again. So it's just the way it's worked out. I'm more surprised than anyone, really.
You've told us many times in your books, but can you, for our listeners, just articulate how it felt standing in front of an audience that must have just frightened the life out of you?
Well, to some extent, it felt easier than it probably did for most people, because I was a psychiatric nurse for 10 years and I worked in a very kind of highly stressful department which dealt with people who are in crisis. So I had a fair bit of abuse, and may I say it was much more eloquent from psychiatric patients than it's ever been from someone in an audience. So to some extent, it didn't faze me in the way it would most people. But there is that kind of terrifying silence when you face them and you think, I've got to make them laugh. And that those few seconds before you start off is absolutely terrifying. But it's not as terrifying as working down a mine or being in a war. So it's all relative, really.
What do you think is the hardest thing that you've ever had to do?
I think probably the hardest things I've ever had to do kind of relate to having been a nurse, really. You know, having to tell people sort of unpalatable news, having to deal with people who are incredibly distressed, and also that applies to certain family things that have happened to me as well. So I would say to me, emotional things are far harder to cope with than physical things.
In the world of the blind and partially sighted, there are people who really aspire to be authors. What words of encouragement would you have for someone in that situation?
Well, I would say do what you really want to do, and if it doesn't succeed, well, then at least you've tried. But I would urge anyone to try anything that they're desperate to do. And I think my advice for aspiring writers would be, try and find the voice inside you that's unique. Don't try and copy any other people's styles or be something that you don't really feel comfortable with. And I always think that ends up as a far more successful novel rather than people that admire someone and try and copy their work.
And if you were going to look back over the things that you've done and then try and predict what the next step is. I know that you're working on something for television. Do you have a clear idea of where your path is going, or is it just the next thing?
I have absolutely no idea. I just pick things randomly as they come up. You know, I wish I was organised enough to have a 10-year plan, but I'm not. I'm a very chaotic person. I just feel very thankful for what I've got and very lucky. I mean, having been a nurse for 10 years, I know what it's like to do that sort of job. So anything else is a bonus to me. So no, don't even know what's in my diary for tomorrow at the moment.
Jay, thank you very much for your time.
You're so welcome. Thanks a lot.
Thanks to Claire Carson and Joe Brand. Look Back in Hunger and It's Different for Girls are both available in various formats from the RNIB library, including as talking books. Do you have a favourite funny book, one that really tickles your ribs? Why not tell us about it? The address, as ever, is readonair@rnib.org.uk. RNIB Talk and Support run telephone social groups for adults with sight loss. You can take part from the comfort of your own home using a landline. Why not phone in to a tele-befriending group to help you socialise and find friendship and support? Or you can share your passion for books and reading by joining a telephone book group. RNIB Connect Radio and Talk and Support have teamed up to form their own book group, so listeners at home can also join the conversation.
I've chosen a book outside of my genre that I mentioned earlier. I've chosen a book not from the crime thriller catalogue or the travel catalogue. Okay. I've chosen a book that was written over 100 years ago, I believe in the 1890s, and it's called The Diary of Nobody.
By
George and Weedon Grossmith. I read it, or listen to it rather, at least once a year. It cheers me up. It really, all it is, it's such a simple story. It's not a long book. I think the audio version is only about 4 hours. Basically what it's about, Iona, is a family, the Pooter family, Charles Pooter, head of house, and his family living in what's regarded as a suburb, but it's Holloway in London. I mean, I don't regard Holloway as a suburb of London now. It's very much a busy part of North London. But in the Victorian time, when this was written, it was regarded as a suburb. And it's a gentle satire, very understated humour about a lower middle class family. He's a clerk in the city, and really it's about their life. And running in the background is obviously a social commentary of the period, which is just before Victoria died. It's fantastic humour. It makes me laugh out loud at times. It brings a smile to my face without realising I'm smiling while I'm listening. That's why I read it once a year, because it really lifts the spirits. It cheers me up. It also proves to me that the best laid plans of man can go wrong. I mean, he's trying to, everything he does, Charles Pooter, for himself and his family, it tends to go wrong, and sometimes acutely embarrassing, I mean, toe-curlingly embarrassing, you know, from dealing with tradesmen like the butcher and the ironmonger, from being invited to the guild hall and having a dance with his wife Carrie on the dance floor. But I won't spoil it for people, but it's the humour in it is running right through it. And, of course, tragedy is not far from humour, or embarrassment is never too far from which, as a blind person, you can really relate to, because we get into some situations that are not funny at the time, but they're funny on reflection. I thoroughly recommend this book. As I say, I don't think you'd be disappointed. It doesn't really fit in any genre. I think it started life in Punch magazine. In 1888, and it was so popular that it was then turned into this book, which has stood the test of time. And if a book written in the 1890s can still make you smile and laugh in the 21st century, I think that says a lot for the writing, doesn't it?
Let's have a listen to the book as available from RNIB.
April the 3rd. Tradesman called for custom, and I promised Farmerson, the ironmonger, to give him a turn if I wanted any nails or tools. By the by, that reminds me, there's no key to our bedroom door. And the bells must be seen to. The parlour bell is broken, and the front door, rings up in the servant's bedroom, which is ridiculous. Dear friend Going dropped in, but wouldn't stay, saying there was an infernal smell of paint. April the 4th. Tradesman still calling. Carrie being out, I arranged to deal with Horwin, who seemed a civil butcher with a nice clean shop. Ordered a shoulder of mutton for tomorrow to give him a trial. Carrie arranged with Borsett, the butter man, and ordered a pound of fresh butter, and a pound and a half of salt ditto for kitchen, and a shilling's worth of eggs. In the evening, Cummings unexpectedly dropped in to show me a meerschaum pipe he'd won in a raffle in the city, and told me to handle it carefully, as it would spoil the colouring if the hand was moist. He said he wouldn't stay, as he didn't care much for the smell of the paint, and fell over the scraper as he went out. Must get the scraper removed, or else I shall get into a scrape. I don't often make jokes.
That book is, of course, available from RNIB Talking Books. Now let's rejoin the conversation on the book group on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you, Alan. Your enthusiasm really shone through there.
I mean, Jane Eyre is a fantastic pick by David. I love Jane Eyre. But I think if on my desert island, Charles Pooter and his family and The Diary of a Nobody is coming with me.
Peggy, over to you. What is your favourite book?
I find this very difficult because I've read so many books throughout my life. One that, the first book that ever made a real impact on me, I think, was one I read as a child, and that was Charles Kingsley's The Water Babies.
Yeah.
And I broke my heart over all these little boys getting sent up the chimneys. And I read and reread that. And I actually might quite like to read it again now as an adult and see what effect it had on me now.
As for chimney sweeping, and being hungry, and being beaten, he took all that for the way of the world, like the rain and snow and thunder, and stood manfully with his back to it till it was over, as the old donkey did to a hailstorm, and then shook his ears and was as jolly as ever, and thought of the fine times coming, when he would be a man and a master sweep, and sit in the public house with a quart of beer and a long pipe, and play cards for silver money, and wear velveteens and ankle jacks, and keep a white bulldog with one grey ear, and carry her puppies in his pocket, just like a man. And he would have apprentices, one, two, three, if he could. How he would bully them and knock them about, just as his master did to him, and make them carry home the soot sacks while he rode before them on his donkey.
Adult books, probably the first one I remember is Pride and Prejudice, which I read first in my teens and have read again several times. And I don't honestly think there's one single book that has impacted on my life. One that I would take to Desert Island would be the collected Brother Cadfile stories by Ellis Peter.
Mm.
I love them.
Very good.
A sort of compendium of them would keep me going quite happily. I don't mind. They are books that I have read and reread. But I just love books. Ever since I was a child, I've read anything and everything.
Yeah, I'm interested in what you said, and also, Alan said also, about rereading a book that you really enjoyed. How important is it to revisit your favourite books, do you think?
I quite like to do it occasionally. I only do it occasionally because I suppose most people do. I have a huge backlog of books that I really still want to read.
Mm.
But I do like every so often I pick up. The other one that I pick up and reread occasionally is the Northern Lights trilogy by Philip Pullen.
Oh, that is absolutely incredible, that book.
That trilogy of books, yeah. Fabulous, and I have reread, I think I've read that now, all three of them about three times. Never get bored with them.
I think the thing about reading a book maybe a second time or picking it up, you know, even after two or three years, I think being part of a book group has really prompted me in that direction because you hear a person's opinion, another person's opinion on the book you've read, and it gives you a different slant. You know, they interpret the book slightly differently to you have first time around.
Yeah.
And I've revisited a book because of something... a group member, a book group member, has spoken about and revisited and said, oh, I missed that the first time round.
I think one of the joys of the book groups is that they introduce you to different authors, people that you haven't read before.
Take you out of your comfort zone, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The other thing about it, David here, the other thing about that is if you read books that are a series of books, like in my case, the Herries Chronicles by Hugh Walpole, when I finished the final book of that, Vanessa, I actually felt a palpable sense of loss. And I knew perfectly well that I would reread them, but the first time was always the best, even though the next time would be really good as well.
Peggy, again, I'm reading the latest Ian Rankin Rebus book, which I was given for Christmas, and I'm thinking, I wonder if there's going to be any more after this. The same, I was sad when Terry Pratchett died because I loved his stuff as well.
This is Ishma here. I talking to Terry Pratchett, I had the opportunity to read the Weird Sisters. It was the play, obviously not the novel, but I have a lot of admiration for his writing. He's very talented.
Terry Pratchett is one of those authors that I've tried very hard to appreciate. And in many ways, I wish I could, because a lot of people that I know love Terry Pratchett. I never really have been able to appreciate him.
The Discworld books are probably the easiest to get along with. I have read some of his other stuff, which was a bit not so easy, but the Discworld, you get, it's very much a satirical view of this world, really. If you look at it, as satire rather than just a story, because a lot of the characters you think, oh, that's based on so-and-so. A lot of political and social comment in it disguised as something from another world.
A kid could open those cuffs, and while Snouty here keeps a very clean jail, he's completely draws at being a guard, said Vimes. This place needs shaken up. He leaned forward, knuckles on the captain's desk, and his face a few inches from the trembling moustache and the milky eyes. $25, or I walk out that door, he said. It was probably a phrase never ever said before by any prisoner anywhere on any world. $25, murmured Tilden, hypnotized. And a rank will be sergeant at arms, said Vimes. Not sergeant. I'm not going to be given orders by the likes of Nock.
Find out which books have inspired our book group members in the pilot episode, which you can hear on Tuesday, March the 7th at 6 p.m, on Saturday the 11th of March at 8 a.m, or downloading the podcast from Audioboom.
RNIB. Supporting people with sight loss.
The RNIB helpline is your direct line to the support and advice you need. Whatever your inquiry, the RNIB helpline team are only a call away with practical and emotional support so you can face the future with confidence. Our friendly, specially trained operators are just a phone call away from 8:45 a.m. and to 5:30 p.m. every weekday. We can help with information on everything you need to know about the RNIB, from eye health, advice on how to volunteer, reading services and loads more, or we can simply offer a listening ear. The RNIB helpline, here for you on 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999.
This is Read On Air.
Recommending a book to someone carries the same risk as giving any gift. Choose well and you've created a bond between you. Get it wrong and it's proof of your differences. And that's doubly true for humorous books. Saying that, I'm a great believer that it's the thought that counts, and receiving any gift puts a smile on my face. So I love being given the titles that you recommend for Educating Red. This week's suggestion came from someone we all know well, and proves just how well he knows my tastes. Over to you, Robert Kirkwood.
Well, we were discussing a future episode about books by comedians and generally funny books, and I asked Red if he'd ever read The Ascent of Rum Doodle, sort of assuming he had given his mountaineering background. But when he said he hadn't, had no hesitation in recommending one of the funniest books I've read. I remember it coming into the Talking Book studios in late 2001. It also came with the print book, which had a big cover splash mentioning a new introduction by Bill Bryson. And being a fan of Bill Bryson, and the fact that the print book wouldn't really be needed for the audio import, I slipped it into my bag for the tube ride home. Well, it was a mistake to read it on the tube, as at one point I didn't so much laugh as snort, startling some of the other passengers. So I waited until I could read it in private and loved it. I've returned to it again and again, and I've been lucky enough to get permission to share it on RNIB Connect Radio's Talking Book Show, and had absolutely no hesitation in recommending it to Red.
If Robert's glowing recommendation wasn't enough to convince me, then Bill Bryson's introduction to the Talking Books version I downloaded from the library using Overdrive soon had me in fits of laughter and keen to be educated. The Ascent of Rum Doodle is, as Bill Bryson says, the funniest book that people have never heard of. It's essentially a Shaggy Dog story in the form of a brilliant parody of classic mountaineering literature. It chronicles the fictional attempt by a group of wonderfully incompetent British climbers to conquer the world's highest peak, the seldom-seen Rum Doodle, elevation 40,000 and a half feet. They are led by Binder, who is as kindly and dogged as he is thick-skinned and dull. Other members of the expedition include Jungle, the route finder who keeps getting lost, Prone, the doctor who is always ill, Constant, the language expert who enrages the 30,000 porters with his attempts to communicate with them, and Pong, the terrifying cook whose meals drive the party to ever greater heights in the hope of losing him on the mountain.
One cannot praise too highly the work of the porters, without whom the expedition would have been doomed to failure. The only one of them who was not worth his weight in bohees was the cook, whose name was Pong. Of all the barbarous 3,000, Pong was probably the most disreputable and the most startling in appearance. His face had a peculiarly flattened look, as though it had been pressed in by a plane surface while it was still soft. This same flattening seemed to have spread to his soul, for a more morose, unresponsive, and uninspiring individual it would be impossible to imagine. His cooking was the reflection of his character. No matter what tempting delicacies he might extract from their tins, the final result was an invariable and appalling dark brown mess which had to be eaten with a strong spoon and contained the most revolting lumps. That we survived his ministrations must be considered a triumph of spirit over matter, for we suffered considerably from indigestion. All attempts to turn him out of the kitchen failed. At the least hint that we were less than delighted with his disgusting concoctions, he went into a kind of frenzy and threatened us with knives. The Bang either could or would do nothing to remove him. Perhaps they had trade union rules about it. However it was, we had to put up with Pong. No small part of our eagerness to get to grips with Rum Doodle was due to the desire, fast becoming an obsession, to get away from him.
This hapless bunch meets every challenge with comfortably predictable disarray, rather like an episode of Dad's Army set in the Himalayas. It's all very silly, but hugely enjoyable, and as Robert predicted, I loved it. But that's not just because I'm a keen climber. With its tongue firmly in its cheek, the book does poke fun at the tendency of mountaineers to appear as distant as the peaks they hope to conquer, and of their memoirs to read like battlefield reports. However, anyone who has been on any kind of organised expedition will recognise the ill-assorted characters the situation throws together and enjoy the running gags. Comedy can be a very personal thing, and when it falls flat, it's horrible. As Bill Bryson writes in the foreword, perhaps no type of comedy is more difficult to sustain over the length of a book than a parody, and I know of none that does it more joyously than Rum Doodle. Perhaps the mark of a truly great comedy is when it takes on a life of its own in the real world. And as Robert Kirkwood found out when he interviewed W.E. Bowman's son, Guy, that's exactly what's happened with Rum Doodle. Robert started by asking whether, like him, most people have only come across the book after its republication with Bill Bryson's introduction.
Yes, I think it probably is, Robert. I mean, I think when it first came out in 1956, there were
a small amount of people who bought it and read it and enjoyed it, and there were quite a few good reviews. And then it went out of print quite quickly, partly because the publishers folded, and it stayed kind of underground until the 1980s. And then there were various reprints in the 1980s. But I think when the new edition came out, with the introduction by Bill Bryson, I think that was when a lot of people discovered it, yeah.
Now, did you actually meet Bill Bryson?
I did, yes. I was very glad. I was. I went to meet him with my mum in his London flat, and he was extremely welcoming and friendly and warm, and he was very good about doing the research. He was very thorough in researching what he was going to write in the introduction. I was very impressed by that.
Do you think your father would have enjoyed the new lease of life the book has had?
Oh, definitely, yeah. I mean, he loved Rum Doodle, and he was very happy in the 1980s when it started to be republished, and I think he would have been extremely happy with Bill Bryson and everything that's happened since.
Now, it's the Isis version we have on Talking Books, using the voice of Terry Whale. How accurate do you think Terry Whale's narration is?
I think he does a great job. I think he's got a great tone of voice, and he's just right for the humour. He doesn't kind of lay it on too thick. You know, he keeps it nice and dry and straight, and so you can laugh at it to yourself, and you can discover it for yourself like you would if you're reading it.
It's been a cult book in mountaineering circles for years, and there have been a few geographical features named in its honour. So where is the real Rum Doodle?
Well, that's a very good question. Very good question, Robert. The first place to be named after the book is in Antarctica. It's near Mawson Station, and there was an Australian expedition, the Australian Antarctic Research Expedition set up a weather station there, and one of the members was a fan of the book, and so they decided that they would call one of these little mountains around it, they would call it Rum Doodle. Well, and then subsequently, I know of three other Rum Doodles around the world. There's one in South Africa, the rest of them are not mountains, they're bits of mountains, like, you know, a crag or a face or something. So there's one in South Africa near Durban. There's one in the States on Pikes Peak, which is one of the largest mountains on the Rockies.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one in Scotland near Loch Maree.
I believe there's also a guest house and a restaurant.
Absolutely, yes. There's a guest house in Australia, in Victoria. The guy who owns the guest house was part of the Australian Antarctic group, and he came back. And he wanted to call his guest house the Rum Doodle Retreat. So he did.
Now tell us about the restaurant. I believe it's in Kathmandu.
That's right. Yes, it's in Tamil in Kathmandu, and it was set up by two brothers, Ashok and Jyoti Pokharel, and they were great businessmen, and they realised that the book was a big favourite amongst climbers, and so they called their restaurant Rum Doodle, and they have got the 40,000 and a half foot bar upstairs where there are lots of feet. And they've even got an Everest Summiteers Club. So if anyone goes to the top of Everest, then they are entitled to be a member of this club, and get free food and free drinks in this restaurant for life. Actually,
oh, fantastic!
Yeah, and I went there a few years ago, and I was very, very lucky that they gave me an honorary membership of this club, even though I haven't been anywhere near Everest, let alone to the top of it.
My thanks to Robert for a truly magnificent Educating Red suggestion. The Ascent of Rum Doodle by W.E. Bowman is Talking Book number 13423. It is brilliantly narrated by Terry Whale, whose surname and voice make him perfectly suited to be a member of Binder's Expedition. Do you have a book that might give me a bit of an education? I'm open to offers. Send me your suggestions by email, readonair@rnib.org.uk. So, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and interviewees, and to everyone who's been in touch about their book groups, the titles you've been enjoying, and your ideas for books I should read up on. And if you want to drop me a line, I'm just an email away. That address once more is readonair@rnib.org.uk. Next week, we'll be talking to some authors who are blind to hear how they craft their words onto a page they might not be able to see. Until then, thanks for listening, and remember to read on.